This is a Touchstone Publishers presentation, your trusted source for leadership knowledge.
So, ladies and gentlemen, as promised, on our podcast today, we're going to work with Vicki Zetsman. She has some great information that you need as a leader to bring things forward, to help you decide how you're going to better structure your company, the management flows and things like that, because a lot of things we've been doing, they're not working. So, Vicki, can you start off and tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got involved in this?
Okay. Actually, I've been a blogger for several years now. My day job is marketing communications, business development, and fundraising for startups and mature companies. And I also have my own blog. I am a published blogger. So how I came into those insights, when I was a salaried person, I went through different stages as any other, you know, salaried person, from interviews to actually working inside companies, big organizations or smaller ones. And all of a sudden, this info starts to accumulate passively. The realization, the things that you start to understand when you work within a company. And as years went by, with advance of technology and technological tools, initially passively you start to see those gaps in logic, in how system works. And I started to put it in writing into my blog, and some of the posts, some of the articles were published later. And you start to connect the dots about technology and modern, I wouldn't say modern, actually, the present day employment policies, which are totally dated and actually counterproductive. Because the output is not growing as it should, bearing in mind the technology advancements and progress.
That brings me to a question for you.
Okay.
What's wrong with the current model, the current mode of employment right now? What's been the challenge? What do you see is causing difficulty?
Well, if you want it in a nutshell, in a soundbite, that we are still working in a 19th century conveyor belt employment mode, or brick in the wall, if you wish. The only things that changed, actually, is that management is using, you know, out of this amazing technology available to us, the management are taking just two things, like, you know, being very general, mails and smartphones. And they think that they're making the work more productive by pestering employees with this barrage of countless mails, even after work hours, or smartphones, you know, allowed us to be accessible 24/7 from wherever, but it doesn't contribute to productivity. What it does, enslaves people even more. I mean, technology was meant to make us more efficient and to be left with more, free time in our personal lives. In reality, it achieved a totally opposite result.
We are working
24/7, we're accessible 24/7, but the productivity, I think, has been stalling in the recent years. And there is this huge elephant in the room, which only few pioneering leaders are you know, brave in inverted commas enough to change?
Well, okay, so there's a few of them. Why are the few of them making that change? Why are a few of them trying to pioneer any kind of change? Because this, like you said, has been going on for a long time.
Well, if I want to be blunt and provocative, there is nice Russian fables that I like to cite. It's a fable of two worms.
Okay.
There is this huge, you know, very cold Russian winter, January. Everything is freezing. There is a pile of, you know, dog poo on the road. Fresh dog poo. And there are two worms inside this pile. Mama worm and the baby worm. And the baby worm pokes its head out, and all of a sudden it sees this bright red, nice smelling apple rolling down the road. And it says to its mama, "Mama, mama, look, there is this nice, you know, beautiful smelling apple. Maybe we should go out of this place and get into it, try it." And then mama says to him, "Listen, we're staying put in this pile here." And the baby worm says, "But it smells vile, it's disgusting." So she says to him, "You know, my son, it smells bad, but it's familiar." I think it sums up pretty much the principle of operations, the modus operandi of, again, I'm making a very broad generalization, of the current business sector. The familiar operation over 150 years hasn't been really changed by technological revolution of the last 20 years. Again, people adopted just a tiny fraction of that change, but not the fundamental, let's say, principle of operation which can make people freer and happier and more engaged. To be honest, and I'm against ageism, but I think most of it has to do with some sort of, let's say, fixated mentality of a certain generation of leaders.
Okay, you're being nice about that. Let me ask you, though, because what you're saying is the comfort zone. So being at a certain age, there's a comfort zone that we all have, and and help me deconstruct if I'm wrong, help me out. But what you're saying as a leader, we're in a comfort zone. We have found ways with technology to measure productivity, not productivity, but measure results, but not really happiness and productivity. We haven't figured out how to really measure the human equation yet.
Yes, and again, it's whatever they're trying to do within their comfort zone, it's like reshuffling your papers on the table. I mean, you move it from one corner to another, hope it will, your table will look better.
But
it doesn't actually, and I mean, I have this, you know, this question or actually complain about this whole industry of organizational consultants and leadership gurus and success mentors and all of those workshops. Apartment saying it's $100 a penny. Where are the results? What are you giving your clients to foster the shift, or will they go operating on this average performance? I don't want to use a stronger word.
Well, you know, and I get the message, and I think the stronger word might be out there, because here's what I see, and I think that you're saying this, and I just want to make sure I'm following you. Leadership gurus, the trainers, the coaches, the consultants, They're teaching in their comfort zone. Their comfort zone is what the computer numbers can tell them, but they're not really producing any true difference in results.
No.
They're wasting people's time and money.
Yeah, you see, I mean, again, there is, you know, there is a cow and the calf. Because, you know, the cow is giving out those billions of consultancy fees to this calf that, you know, is taking it, but, I mean, I think it goes into some sort of black hole that is not producing anything. It's producing more of the same. And I'm really intrigued by this whole, you know, closed circle of nothingness. Because you see, where the change was made, it was made out of a certain, let's say, courage and inquisitive minds of founders who were not scared to take risks. They were not risk averse.
Okay. What I want to do, I want to go deeper into that, but I want to ask you this before we go deeper into that, because I think that it sounds like you're starting to lean toward tell us about the solution, but I want to ask you a little bit. This 150-year cycle, this has been going on forever. Is it about ready to play out, do you think? You think it's exhausted of energy, or do you think it's going to continue?
Well, you know, again, another, let's say, biblical example. It depends if you want to see the full, the half full glass or half empty. So, okay. I mean, there is this biblical example of Hebrews Exodus from Egypt. When God, if we, let's say, for believers, okay, when God called upon Moses and told him, listen, you are going to take your people out of slavery in Egypt and bring them to the promised land, he told him something like that. You will be wandering in a desert for 40 years. And you and that generation, the generation of slaves, will see the promised land, but you will not enter it. And the reason behind it was that in a new place, you don't want to bring traces or, let's say, legacy of slavery. So that whole generation of slaves had to die out. Now, I hope to be more optimistic than that, but if you look at the current leadership of both, let's say, big corporations and smaller companies, they look to me like a generation of slaves. They were raised on certain precepts. Mm-hmm. They like to stick to those precepts. They did adopt certain, let's say, usages of technology. But I'm not sure that they actually internalize and are willing to accept and to unlock the full potential of that technological progress.
Okay. So in time, as each generation goes, it might get there. It's going to take a little bit of time. Here's, though, the question I want to ask you about that. From a management perspective, what fixes it? If I'm going to start a brand new company or take over a company as a manager, what fixes it? If I'm going to be a coach or a leadership guru, what fixes it?
What fixes it? Well, actually, right now, there are several examples of modules that actually work. They have been tried, and they work. Again, in a nutshell, it's called flexible working patterns. One of them is holacracy, which actually says, again, in a sound bite, you flatten the pyramid, the managerial pyramid, and you focus the employees around tasks without you know, actually add-ons of managerial, of, let's say, middle management, you know, supervisors. There are companies like Zappos, for example, that are a good example of that. And when the founder decided to change its company structure completely, flattening the pyramid, he called, you know, company meeting and announced that and said, listen, people who feel that they cannot work independently without supervision will be, you know, free to leave with all the, you know, severance plan, whatever they signed on when they joined the company. So the interesting statistics were that 15% of the workforce decided to leave, but 85 stayed and they're successfully working, collaborating on tasks and projects without actually some sort of middle managers reviewing them, supervising them, you know, just without the slave driver's base. Another module is flexible, also, again, flexible work pattern. For example, you profile your company operation, what your company does. And it can be, let's say, a bigger company, it can be a manufacturer, it can be a service provider, it can be anything. And you just break down your company's department into different segments. You have marketing, you have HR, you have maybe production floor, if you have it, if you are a manufacturer, you have assembly, you have different things. And then you start to think how you can change the work pattern to a more flexible structure, to allow your employees more say on how they work. For example, technology. We're speaking about technology. Listen, take, for example, marketing. If you support marketing activity by technological means, actually, you don't have to have full office tenancy for marketers. Some of the things they can do on remote, they can come for staff meetings, they can come for presentations, they can come in for different things. But some of the tasks can be performed out of the office according, you know, and they can be responsible for how they do it. Same goes for HR. You know, production. I mean, right now, I think most of the production is fully automated. So maybe you can shorten the shifts and allow people more time, you know, a better work-family balance. Now, without cutting their pay, because now you are truly paying for performance and for output, at not for hours spent on the premises. And when, because what happens right now, for example, with a very efficient, you know, excellent employee, if, for example, management sees that they can perform the task in less time than, you know, usual average, they won't reward him with some sort of more free time or higher salary. No, they will impose more tasks on them. So it's not worth their while to be good and to outperform, because it's not like they will be paid more. On the contrary, they will get the message that the better they are, the more they are overloaded.
Okay, so I understand that, and that makes a lot of sense. And then, like I said, that 15% who left or who would be asked to leave anyway, because they're not even trying. So if we can unpack that just a little bit, if we can flatten our organization, I'm going to ask you to define that a little bit better. If we can flatten that organization out a little bit and then give ownership of the task, of the duties to the employees and have them be responsible for those?
Yeah, delegating responsibilities, yes.
Okay, so that's key. That's critical, having them take on the responsibility. To play devil's advocate, though, larger companies, medium-sized companies, they don't feel like they can keep track of the work, keep track of the production, or have control over the quality unless they have several layers of managers. How do we overcome that thinking?
Well, again, we have to be realistic. I think, again, after the leadership of those corporations sit down and break down, I mean, if there is a will, if there is at all initial will to change anything, break down the company to segments and see how they can change the operation within each of those segments. Now, I don't think, again, it's like it's at this point, it's some sort of theoretical thought that should be actually tried out. In any case, they would be able to flatten the pyramid, even within each segment, to a better, a slimmer structure than there is now in place. And then they can see how they can shift each segment into a more flexible employment mode without, again, and I'm stressing that, without cutting people's pay. So they will get the message that it's worthwhile for them to be more productive, more efficient, more productive, because the pay stays the same. And it's one bonus. The other one is that they have more leisure time with their families or themselves.
So a way we could set this up is to say, okay, here's your task. You own it. You do it in high quality. You get the job done with it. If it takes you 5 hours instead of the number 8 hours, I'm not going to add 3 more hours of work to you. Get the 5 hours done.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So, and again, listen, in big corporations, there will be some sort of middle management who has to review the structures, even the slimmer one. But I don't think it will be in such numbers as exist now, and the pyramid will be flattened for sure.
Well, okay, so again, playing the devil's advocate role just a little bit. In the typical management situation, so you should only have between 7 to 14 direct reports. If you flatten the structure out, you can go anywhere from, you can go into the hundreds of direct reports then. Help me deconstruct this. So if you have that many people who are direct reports to you now, then the flattening out will not work unless the team that is reporting to you has taken on responsibility for what's taken place.
Sorry, I didn't get the question.
Okay, so the question is, am I thinking about it right? That's the question. Am I thinking about it right? So if I, instead of me having to manage 14 or so direct reports, if I flatten my organization out and remove some of those middle managers, then I may have up to 100 people who directly report to me.
Well, again, I think... I'm not sure. Again, it's all theoretical. It should be tested, of course.
Okay.
I'm not sure that there will be 100 direct reports. Because if you bundle people around tasks, in the end, you may have the same 14 reports because it will be reports of groups.
Oh, okay.
It won't go through another conduit, middle conduit. If you say, okay, so we say, okay, we just cut the middleman and we have 100 employees who are supervised, you know, in a chain of 5 people. So now there are 100 and, you know, and some sort of chief supervisor. He actually, after revision, after analysis, he prepares, let's say, 5 tasks or 6 tasks. And he groups the employees around those tasks. So each group submits performance report.
So each group is in charge of their task and how they choose to get the task completed, how they choose to be productive, their job is to complete that task. So I wouldn't be getting reports from every person. I'd just be getting reports from whoever that group decided to come report to me that month or that week.
Well, then in such case, the ball goes back to the employees. They have those who remain and wish to work independently have to arrange the work within the group. This is how Zappos works.
I was just going to say that because that article in our pre-discussion, you were able to get me an article by Forbes. From Forbes with Drew Hansen, and it laid out how he at Zappos decided that he's going to get this done. And I guess for a while there, maybe I'm not remembering correctly, but for a while there, he was trying to do both ways, the old style and the newer style of management. And then he finds that I had enough of that. He went strictly new.
Yeah, well, in the end, the group has to be responsible enough for this whole structure to work. The group has to be responsible enough to group around the task for the best performance possible. And this can be done only with people who have some sort of inner drive for performance, especially if they're let go of this hook of, you know, reviews and, measurements or whatever.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about human nature and then the psychology behind this, because what we're looking at is a complete change of how the employees treat it.
Yes. Yes.
Tell me your thoughts about that a little bit.
I think it can be a huge boost to employee self-esteem because they stop seeing themselves as, you know, Marx said, means of production, like almost robotic means of production. And they start to see themselves as people who are listened to, who are trusted. You know, I mean, I had this conversation with a guy who for I think 10 or 15 years now is trying to implement into organizational structures the module he took from one of our, let's say, intelligence services. He comes from those intelligence services. And they excel in recruiting agents. So after he retired, he took the idea, said, why is this organization is so good in recruiting agents? And he started to analyze it. And one of the first things that he is trying to unlock now in a business world is the basic fundamental point that the knowledge lies within the company, within the employees. Thing is that the management rarely listens to employees or their input is of any value. They prefer to pay millions to external consultants who come in, do some sort of superficial checks, and pardon my saying, including McKinsey and Bain and all the other big shots. Yeah. And I won't go into it now because I heard different things about it. I mean, same thing about different companies that, you know, the managers sign the contract and the interns write the report, do the analysis and write the report. So, but they commission, you know, huge fees for that. So basically, the knowledge, the internal knowledge that is within the employees of any organization goes undetected. Now, in Holacracy, this knowledge is actively uncovered and implemented because the responsibility to perform lies within the group. So the group will decide how or what is the best way to deliver results. They don't need the manager collects results, but the performance is left within the employees. The freedom to perform, to do things the best they can, lies now within the employee without some sort of external imposition that exists actually right now, and I think doesn't actually deliver.
So when an employee is responsible for it, they own it, they have the authority, that, yes, just that ideal right there will cause that employee, if I'm understanding correctly, will cause that employee to start looking at doing the job better, start bringing in their knowledge, their level, their learnings, so they can, yes, do the job better.
To unlock the internal, the huge potential of internal knowledge, because they know, that they have to own it, and the bonus is, the reward is their freedom of personal life and freedom of means to do things within their company.
I had the one thing I was did today, and based a little bit off of what I've learned from you so far, this is probably another avenue that helps change this. I noticed I was watching a group interview where they're interviewing people in the group, and you can see, you know, the loss of interest or the lack of interest, especially when they mentioned how much they were going to get paid. Now, they're paying this group of people just slightly above minimum wage. But when they mentioned that they could work from home in a couple months, that really seemed to motivate the folks. Is that part of your management structure too, you think? Allowing people that flexibility, work flexibility?
Yes. Yes, definitely. And I'll tell you why. And again, I'll be very blunt because, you know, counter arguments for not working from home is, oh, we don't have a supervision of what they are doing. Maybe they are doing something else. Maybe they are not working. And I'll say to it, you know what? Maybe. Why should you care if they deliver? If the task is done and the performance is great, why should you care how much time they spent to do it? And if they spent less time but are delivering great results, why should you care? If they can do that task unsupervised in 2 hours, and the other time dedicate either to leisure or to some sort of other, you know, initiative that they want to do. Why should you bloody care?
Let me stop you for a second there, because I really want our leadership teams to hear that. If they are producing better than what they have been, if they have ownership, why do you care how long it took them?
Exactly.
Thank you for watching this presentation from Touchstone Publishers. Please subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new episodes are published.
Okay, let's continue with part two from Vicky Seisman.
And again, I'll be very blunt because, you know, counter arguments for not working from home is, oh, we don't have a supervision of what they are doing. Maybe they are doing something else. Maybe they are not working. And I'll say to it, you know what? Maybe. Why should you care if they deliver? If the task is done and the performance is great, why should you care how much time they spend to do it? And if they spend less time but are delivering great results, why should you care? If they can do that task unsupervised in 2 hours, and the other time dedicate either to leisure or to some sort of other, you know, initiative that they want to do. Why should you bloody care?
Let me stop you for a second there, because I really want our leadership teams to hear that. If they are producing better than what they have been, if they have ownership, why do you care how long it took them?
Exactly. Hours, and this is precisely my point of contention. In the current reality of technology, hours are totally obsolete. They are totally irrelevant. Because I think 40% of time spent in the office is not spent on work. It's spent on chit-chat. It's better on winding, and it should be so, because humans are not robots. They cannot work non-stop for hours. I think the best concentration span is about hour and a half, and then a person needs a break to unwind of 10 to 15 minutes, and then to continue with tasks. Now, let's take, for example, a 9-hour workday. About 3 or 4 hours of that time is spent on non-work related activities. An hour of lunch break, chit chat with colleagues, surfing the internet, showing presence, but not actually working. Now, what businesses get, they get some sort of social gathering, imposed social gathering, because naturally you don't like all of your colleagues, you may not like your boss, you don't want to spend 9 hours in the office with them, you would prefer to do something else or be somewhere else, but you are forced to let's say dedicate 30 or let's say 40% of your time to some sort of professional social gathering that you necessarily want to attend, and it won't entice you to be more productive. It will entice you to be there because this is what you're paid for. You're paid for your bum, you know, on the chair behind your desk, showing presence.
Okay, so why wouldn't that work? Okay, if we're going to give the employee responsibility to get the job done and give them the freedom, the flexibility, why wouldn't that work?
Who said it wouldn't? Thing is that the main block for that is the leadership of the companies who are totally risk averse, who are totally, let's say, addicted to what has been. You know, I mean, look, it's the same mode of operation that has been from the 19th century. Some minor add-ons of technology, again, mainly chiefly, I think the only thing, communication technology has been added to it, but not the communication technology that can profoundly change the work pattern. Video conferences, allowing, you know, people to work on remote, you know, those, I mean, you know, people can manage workers in China via video conference, but they are reluctant to allow their employees, you know, in the office to work from home and to video conference for meetings. It's nuts. It's totally crazy. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, it makes sense. And today I had the pleasure of watching an interview process, and based upon our conversation to get ready for this, it kind of made me start to think, well, there are some instances where that may not work. But you just said them. That may not work if the managers, if the owners of the company, if the CEO of the company still has that old school thinking that they have to have the thumb down on somebody. They got to have complete control over people.
It's called micromanagement, to have people on a very short leash. I think it boosts egos, but it's not. And again, you know, this is what makes me think that companies, because they favor the old ways, even if the productivity has fallen, it's like, okay, average is good enough, or let's say mediocre is good enough, because excellence entails taking risks. Excellence entails having a very thorough thought how to be more effective through making people happy, through engaging, you know, I mean, there is this whole, you know, organizational jargon of engagement, motivation, you name it. And again, I'm looking at it and I'm saying, well, where are the results? I mean, you can't take an average Joe, a burned out average Joe, under the boot of his middle manager, you know, run him through leadership course and turn him into some sort of motivated wizard. It doesn't work that way. He has no incentive to be better, because nothing in his reality, in his employment reality, changes. He still has his middle, you know, the slave driver. He still has those bloody reviews. He still has to, you know, to go through, you know, nine rings of hell and fire, and spend, you know, his valuable years chained to a desk. Why would he be, why would he want to be better?
That same thing would apply if you still have those same things going on, still measuring results the same way, still thinking about micromanaging people. Even if you did have them work from home, did create a little bit of flexibility for them to work from home, they still have to work 8 to 10 hours a day to get that 8-hour paycheck. They still have to be signed on all that time. So that might be the only reason, if you try to take that, if you try to live in both of the worlds here, you have to be on the phone 8 hours a day. You have to be in teleconference 8 hours a day, even though they could get the job done in 5. That may be the only reason why that didn't work. Now, I tell you why I bring up that question, though, for you real quick. It was just announced today that the Internal Revenue Service here in the United States is recalling all the home workers, making them all come back to the office. And they say it's for lack of productivity from those home workers. I think we might agree that it might be because of lack of responsibility being given to those home workers.
Well, listen, if they have, you know, there are those monitors, I think internet monitors that you have to, you know, update every time you begin and finish the task. It's the same thing, in my view, as working from office, because you're still monitored. Now, again, there will always be this percentage of people who want to be supervised, who are slaves within, you know, for whom working independently is something for their reasons. I have no idea. I'm not a psychologist. For their reasons, they don't want to do. That's fine. Question is what is their portion in organization? Are they a majority? Are there, let's say, half of the employees? Are they a minority, like in Zappos? I mean, don't throw the baby with the bathwater, because there are some, let's say, less motivated employees or burned out employees. Don't enslave the rest who can own their performance. Don't punish them.
I agree with that. And another question kind of comes up with that, because if you start looking at the whole versus the minority, will this flattening of the organization and giving that level of responsibility and ownership, you think that works better in a union shop or works negative?
Well, I'm not very knowledgeable about unions, but you have to check with the unions if people's pay is not affected, if working, let's say nominally, hour-wise, working less does not harm the pay, I don't think why would they object. I don't see any reason for objection.
There shouldn't be, but there is going to be, just based upon how unions are reported to work. So, okay, I know that's a little bit out of the range there of what we're discussing, but I'm just curious about that. So I want to point you in a direction that may be counterintuitive for me and what I do. You know, I run a publishing company, but we also do speaking and training and coaching.
Okay.
Coach me on how to set this up, how to go into a company and say, this is what you need to do. But I want you to coach me from the standpoint of why. Why do I need to go in and do this? If I'm going to give 100% guarantee that they're going to grow and get better, tell me why I should do this in my work with them.
Well, I guess if a company engages you, they feel that there is something not working within their organization. They feel that there is some sort of problem somewhere. Maybe their sales are not high enough. Maybe the operational aspect is not good enough. There is a principle of, like with kids or actually sports people. When you train in the beginning, everything is hard. You train hard in order to be the best. And if you take it from sports, for example, from sports world, you train very hard to get the best results possible. Now, training hard should be done smartly. Now, when you come into the company and you learn their problem, you see what the problem is, and the biggest thing is to earn employees' faith. They should be open enough with you to feel they can trust you, that you will not report them like some sort of, you know, complaining, or you have to work with them. Now, when you learn the situation, you have to be able to say, listen, you have to check to the leadership, and you have to change the disc in your mind, how you operate this thing. And actually, it's to your benefit. You will get more revenue and you will get more profit, but you will you must step out of your comfort zone and forget this mantra of, but we have been doing this that way for ages. You have to erase it completely from your psyche, from your business psyche. And if you want to increase delivery, you have to train hard, to train yourself, your perception, to change your perception and get better results and to beat competition. If we're talking about business sector, to beat competition, to become more agile and fast in your response. But for this, you have to harness your employees. The only way you can harness your employees into this is by relaying that you trust them, that their conditions, salaries, other things, you know, the whole package won't be affected, and that they will have more say how to run the company. Actually, when you delegate responsibility, your employees are running the company. You see, because you don't have this, you know, middle management layer that is allegedly running the company. Employees are running the company. And they feel responsible. I mean, those who cannot do that will leave anyway. But those who can will be, I think, their efficiency will multiply. This is, I mean, this is my two cents.
Okay, so as a coach, trainer, if I go into someplace, I need to help them change their mindset, basically.
Yes.
Okay.
After you learn the issue, after you learn what's hurting them.
Okay, all right. So, and
listen, you know, again, there is this organizational cliche, you cannot get to different, you know, different results employing the same means that got you to the problem.
Yes, yes, absolutely. That's absolutely true. That changed that a little bit. Now, there's some organizations who are going to be honest, a lot of our audience is going to be in this area. As a nonprofit organization that's government funded, for example, they're going to have, each grant has rules and regulations that they have to follow. Depending on what state they work for in the United States, they're going to have different rules, different regulations. But if they don't follow these, they're going to fail and get shut down or get huge fines or get something's going to happen of that nature. So the excuse is, well, we have to micromanage this to avoid this. If we train people on the rules and policies and procedures, and we give them the authority to run the shop, and they understand if they break those rules and procedures, there's consequences for it, then we can flatten the organization. Would you agree?
Yes, exactly. Question is, and I guess you are more knowledgeable about those things, there is a fundamental question, how much wiggle room you have within those, you know, regulations. In any even strictest, you know, pattern, there is some sort of wiggle room. And within that wiggle room, you have to engage the employees.
Well, you know what, though? That's, well, you just kind of hit it right there. Because if whatever that wiggle room is, that's what you can allow the employees to have. And they have to know what that wiggle room is. They have to know what they can and can't do. And they have to be held responsible for that. But I think when you say the problem with coaches and leaders and gurus, the problems with those folks are, okay, so the problem with those type of situations is that the coaches, the leaders, the gurus, they don't know the regulations. They don't know the wiggle room. And they go in with some of this old, tried stuff that takes place. So it sounds like to me both the leaders and the trainers and the coaches need a mind shift.
Totally, totally. And you see, I often see those, you know, gurus or mentors on LinkedIn, and I'm just reading what they post, and I'm in total disbelief how any organization would employ them, because the only thing they say is a quote, some sort of motivational quips, or something from, you know, the same, let's say, couple of billionaires like Bill Gates or Richard Branson or Jeff Bezos or Steve Jobs, the same quotes from 10 different self-appointed, I don't know, mentors, business wizards, whatever they call themselves. And I'm looking at it, for goodness sake, just go into any bookshop, buy self-help book, and, you know, go and do anything with it. I mean, it's crazy. No innovation, no some sort of thought change, nothing, just cheap cliches, actually. The same thing from Steve Jobs, the same thing from Bezos, the same thing from Obama, you know.
Yeah.
And I really, for the life of me, can't understand how they get business.
Well, they actually, I believe that they're trying to do what they think the owner wants. If the owner is a Steve Jobs fan, they want to hear that. So, but that's the mind shift that has to take place all the time. You got to get out of that. Now the clients or the leaders out there who want to stay, well, I call it the George Patton leadership syndrome, where they want to stay in control like we used to have in control how the military used to be structured. Okay. Those type of leaders, there's still a lot of out there, and you may be right that they have to grow out of that. What I want to know is, how do we get them to make sure they're not taking that same idiom and giving it to the younger managers and saying, this is the way you have to do it?
Well, first of all, listen, if they're just functioning as a yes man to their client, I think it's a total gross, you know, unprofessionalism.
Incompetence, yes.
Yeah, actually, it's like betraying your client. Because if your client is taking company money and throwing it down the drain to hear something they want to hear, there is something very wrong with that attitude. Now, making the client, you know, to acknowledge to themselves that some sort of change is needed, you have to open their mind to it. I mean, you have to feel the client, you have to understand its psyche and then shift it into direction of change. And listen, you know, if the client doesn't want to start that change, then I don't know how much work you can do with them. I mean, if they're inviting you, if they're paying you to hear what they want to hear, if they are expecting some sort of sugar-coated more of the same, then, I mean, it's your professional integrity, and either you take it, you agree to it, or you don't. I mean, but you have, I think, to make it very, very clear that change or results or better results won't show from doing it with the same means that actually got them into the problem in the first place.
Okay, so leaders, let's put the focus back on you. Okay, if you are bringing in people into train and they're not challenging your current way of thinking, okay, if they're not giving you something new, that training may not be worthwhile. If they're going to just agree with you and say, okay, yeah, you need this, you need that, you need that, and they don't sit down and say, okay, no, what you need is maybe this. If they're not able to stand up to you to say, I see what you're saying there. I see the problem, and I understand where you're going with that. You could do this. We need a different thought, though. We need to create employee ownership and employee flexibility. You got to something. That's all I'm saying. So leaders, that's what I think. That's why I asked Vicky to come on with us. Maybe it's time for us to start thinking that the strength of the company is at the bottom of the company.
Yes, but be careful, because you see, again, even today, I mean, there are, you know, those organizational buzzwords. So employee ownership, excellence, unlocking, potential, whatever. All coaches, all mentors are using that jargon. Question is, can they actually implement?
That's just it, yeah.
Can they actually implement and realize that jargon hands-on, or does it just stay as some sort of, you know, ephemeral buzzwords that are thrown around again and again, and actually everything stays the same? So they will, you know, organizational restructure. Just, you know, cut like 10% of workforce, your operational profit will go up. You don't need a coach for that, please.
And all this happens because I flatten my organization, and my members of my organization, they have the intelligence, the power to put this together. That all that happens because of just flattening the organization.
Not just that. Okay. I mean, again, we're talking hypothetical. It's a scene game, actually, what we're doing now. So after you learn your client's structure, you shouldn't be rigid in just, maybe there is, after you learn, you know, the situation, maybe there is only one thing, like flattening the pyramid. But maybe you will have to come in with several tools, with flattening, with flexible work pattern, with different things that all together may result into, to truly unlocking excellence. I mean, it won't be a buzzword anymore, hollow, meaningless buzzword. It will be something that you can actually show for to your client, saying, listen, I mean, it's a journey. It won't happen overnight. It may happen over 6 months. It may happen over a year. But it's better than having a situation where within a year you will be lagging behind your competitors and may even be dying out because you're an outdated dinosaur who cannot really realize its market share, its true market share.
Okay, so this is what I want to ask you to do. And I want you to let people know how they can get some time with you so you can help consult on these issues. Okay. What do people have to do to get a hold of you so they can consult with you and figure out, okay, you know, how do I get this to work for my company? I want to reduce turnover. I want to increase productivity. I don't want the same old cliche that I've been getting. How do people get a hold of you?
I think best thing is through LinkedIn, through my LinkedIn account.
Okay, perfect.
And you have it if you wish. Just post it in the podcast.
Yeah, I will absolutely. And that is actually, I tell you from first-hand experience, ladies and gentlemen, you put something on her LinkedIn account, she's going to get back to you.
Yeah. So if people wish to contact me and, you know, to do some consultancy, I will be more than happy to. Thing is, you know, it's also an interesting, another aspect of it that you have to consider. Whether it's a family company where the CEO is also a member of that family, or is the CEO a hired external professional? Because, and you have to differentiate with whom you are working, because, and again, I will be blunt. If a CEO is a hired external professional, but the owners of the company are very dominant, maybe even if he wants to implement the change, maybe he's not allowed to. Maybe you will have to go above him and work with the owners or with the board directors to allow the change. You have to profile very carefully the structure of the company, not only of the employees, but also of the upper leadership. You have to be very, very insightful and see who you are working with and where are the bottlenecks.
So I will add on to that a little bit. Leaders, if you're out looking for someone to come in and do your training, if they're not doing that work for you, if they're not being insightful and they're not paying attention to your company, they're not looking at the culture, you're not going to get your dollar's worth.
Yes, and you have to pay attention to internal squabbles and power battles, you know.
Yes.
Because sometimes bottlenecks are there. Blockages are there. You have to be, you know, to be honest, you have to be a psychologist, a person with very deep insight into all this entangled, you know, structure of organization. And for example, listen, I'll give you an example, okay?
Okay.
That I came across from my fundraising experience. I was asked to help with the sale of a certain allegedly successful startup.
Okay.
It was in the sphere of cyber intelligence, and the startup was successful. It was a young company, but paying dividends and everything seemed fine. And we didn't know why two of the founders wanted to sell. So when I brought them to this financial group, a private equity bank, and the founders who, well, they were the brain behind this company. And when the private equity bank asked them, listen, why if you're so successful and you have clients and you're profitable and you are paying dividends each year, why do you want to sell? And they said, listen, we have trouble with our partners.
Uh-huh.
They said, the money, the profits that comes into company, we don't want to pay dividends. We want to bring it back into the company in order to expand, to add more people, to add more, let's say, to expand the offering. And our partners don't want that. They're happy with the dividends. They're happy with the situation as is. And they are actually restricting the growth of the company to such an extent that we cannot go on anymore because it's our reputation in stake. And the company actually stagnates.
So
what I mean, it's like an analogy because, for example, if you go into a company that on the face of it is very successful, but it's not growing, you have to go and look where are the blockages. Where is a challenge? It may not be the burnout employees at the base, you know, the little employees.
Right.
It may be somewhere in the pinnacle that restricts the growth and fulfilling the full potential of that organization.
Leaders, what she's saying here, and if I'm not going to say it right, correct me. You need to step back and look and pay attention and notice what's taking place. Notice and also be able to hear the meaning behind the words being offered. That was costly. The analogy you just shared was costly. Your two brains of the group wanted out.
Yeah.
all because you probably didn't listen or didn't notice the signs. Leaders, you got to notice the signs.
It's not only signs, it's not signs anymore. It's like explicit wish of, let's say, financial partners who invested in that startup. They said, listen, we don't want anything anymore. We recouped our investment. We're happy with the situation as is. We're happy to have our dividends, and we don't care about anything else. It's like a cash cow.
Yeah, and if you're not paying attention to that,
the cash cow will stop giving milk. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, asking for trouble. Yeah, that's perfect. That's perfect. So there's a lot of work to be done here, and a lot of things to consider. We need to depack this a little bit further. I mean, it's just a lot of things to put together in this package. We haven't even begun to touch some of these socioeconomic issues that are involved in this type of work. We haven't begun to touch some of those things. So I want to invite you back sometime in the near future so we can...
Okay.
Because, you know, we need another hour and a half to just deal with the socioeconomic part of this.
Of course, because everything is, connected. It's all of communicating vessels. I mean, you cannot detach business from social aspect and from politics. I mean, it's totally intertwined.
And by the way, I just thought about this. It's totally intertwined, and the technology is totally intertwined. And sometimes we take our technology too much for, we don't think about it. We don't focus on it. We don't use it the right way. Reason why we do this podcast is we want to reach out to the world. Where are you at right now, Vicky?
I'm in Israel.
Ladies and gentlemen, leaders, your technology is strong enough where you can run the world. But you got to pay attention to what you're learning. You got to listen to leaders like her, thought leaders like Vicky, to see them grab a hold of this. We're going to have Vicky back with her permission really soon, probably at least maybe another one pair, maybe have one other podcast and have her back, because we need to really start diving deep on how to, you said it yesterday or the day before, release the intellectual power of our employees so that we can grow and be profitable and have happy places to work and have happy lives.
Exactly, because you see, I think, and maybe it's for another really podcast, I will briefly touch on the example of the German companies that I told you about yesterday, and it's an amazing example, you know, because it exemplifies how by one step so many issues are resolved actually and prevented. Now, I was a brand manager for this importer of bathroom and kitchen fittings. And I was sent to one of the manufacturers in Germany, which is the biggest manufacturer of jacuzzis and shower basins. Actually, it is a family company. Actually, it started pre-World War I, and they were doing artillery and military, you know, having military equipment. After World War II, they shifted completely to civil market for obvious reasons. And since then, since after World War II, they actually excelled in producing amazing things, totally amazing things. Part of it is used in hospitals and, other health clinics. Really, really genius guys. Now, the company is a family company. Third or even fourth generation is taking the reins. And I was there and I was amazed because the factory is situated in that part of Germany with, I think, 70% of Turkish population. Now, those Turks, most of them, I think, are already German citizens. Some of them are, newcomers. but 70% of community in that region are Turks, and only 30 are, let's say, native white Germans. Now, when you go into that factory, the production floor is amazing. It's like some sort of futuristic thing from Matrix or whatever, you know, huge robotic arms. And the Turkish workers only pushing the buttons. It's amazing. Now, what the owner, the family of that company did was, and bear in mind that Germany is one of those socialistic, you know, European countries with an amazing welfare system. Amazing. German welfare system is one of the best in the world. Now, the family decided to contribute to community in that place. And they went into schools and council and said to them, listen, we want to work with problematic youth, teenagers usually, who are on the brink of being expelled from high schools and thrown into the streets. Problematic behavior, I don't know if it's gangs, drugs, whatever, but who are on the verge of becoming delinquent. So they started this program of taking those kids that are 15, 16, something like that, and entering them into internship in the factory. And on one hand, training them and allowing them to gain a very respectful vocation and useful vocation. On the other hand, giving them free hands to create whatever they want from the materials of that factory. And when I was there, I saw the product that those kids made. It's out of this world. It's futuristic bottle openers, which are so, because they are so, you know, the design is so modern and so great, it's sold in those swanky, you know, design shops. The kids were brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the most talented ones, after they proved themselves for a year or two, the company, the family, sends them to colleges for higher education at their expense, factory company's expense. Now, think about it in a wider context of going into community. And again, Germany is a welfare state. On the face of it, they could say, oh, listen, we have a good, you know, welfare network. And, you know, we try to rehabilitate those families, those children, you know, the best way we can. But the company said, no, we're providing additional safety net. We don't want to pick those kids from the streets. We want to prevent them ever going into the streets. So just imagine the power of this concept in any other parts of the world. And
well,
it doesn't help.
I'm sorry, I was just going to say, because if you imagine that, the power of that concept, you also can imagine the power that that delivers to their employees, as well as to the children who are behind and needs the help, as well as to the community. And that's, you can't even begin to measure that.
Exactly. Exactly.
So we need to work on that. We've got to get some work in that area.
Okay. So, we'll be happy to.
Okay, fantastic. All right. So again, in the show notes, I'm going to give everybody your LinkedIn address. Plus,
okay,
you sent me over a couple articles. The one I really would like for everybody to look at, and it'll be in the show notes, it lists companies that are actually running their companies with this module management. And I think that that is something just for a little bit of social proof, so you can see that, yeah, if you do this, it's not that bad, because a lot of other folks are doing it, a lot of folks making a difference. Vicky,
and
any last? Go ahead.
Take- What is interesting is at least that the companies are not all in the same sector. There are different sectors. There are manufacturing companies, there are service companies, there are different companies.
I noticed that, and I agree with that. That different industries, and it can put it all together all the way across the board. I want to give you the last word here for this episode. What do you want to leave as a message? And we'll let that conclude for us for today.
Well, the people just need to open their minds. You know, in Asian philosophy, it's called empty your cup. You know, Asians, Japanese or Chinese, they drink tea. And they always say that if your cup is full, you cannot pour any more tea into the cup. Tea meaning it being knowledge. So you have to empty your cup and open your mind to maybe some better possibilities.
Thank you for watching this presentation from Touchstone Publishers. Please subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new episodes are published. Thank you for watching this presentation from Touchstone Publishers. Please subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new episodes are published.